Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Lauren Chulgen, and this is The Exchange. NPR's Lulu Garcia-Navarro has painted vivid pictures for listeners of revolution, uprisings, and crackdowns, protests and battlefields, and in the most dangerous places for journalists, the Middle East and Latin America. And now she's our steady hand on Sunday afternoons, guiding us through the roller coaster of the week's news, whether it's the devastating California fires or Benedict Cumberbatch's portrayal of the Grinch. Today, Lulu is hanging out with us for most of this hour. She's in town to honor journalist James Foley, who was killed by the Islamic State in 2014 after being held hostage. Foley was honored yesterday by the New Hampshire Supreme Court Society, and Lulu gave an emotional keynote about press freedom. So she and I are going to chat about the state of journalism, both here and abroad, and maybe we'll convince her to give us a podcast recommendation. Speaking of podcasts, later this hour, my NHPR colleague Taylor Quimby's dropping by to fill us in on the latest and pretty unorthodox episode of our Outside In podcast. It brought up some questions about journalistic ethics and picking sides. So if you have questions for Lulu or for Taylor, and I know you do, so please send them in. Send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also write us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or of course, give us a call 1-800-892-6477. But let us begin with a very familiar voice on these airwaves, Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Thank you for swinging by NHPR while you're in town.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So let's start with Jim Foley. I mean, as you know, his name's pretty well known to our listeners, as he's from New Hampshire and grew up here. So what did you want to share last night with his family and those who gathered to honor him?
It was an incredibly meaningful event, and I wanted to participate. When I was asked, I was deeply honored. Jim was a fearless journalist. The way he died was horrific. And Diane and John Foley have turned tragedy into a mission. They really have made something that is horrible and painful into something that helps all journalists with their work for hostages. They work for journalist safety and other issues related to James Foley's life and work. So I think the award was deeply meaningful for them. And as you mentioned, they're from this state, and I was honored to be a part.
And it seems, you know, he's been given many awards after his death, and I think it's been a nice way for the state and also for journalists to look back and keep remembering his legacy.
I think so, because when something like this happens, it can just be one death among many, right? But it is important to focus on the kinds of work that he did, that other journalists do. I mean, one of the things I spoke about last night is that, you know, 43 journalists have been killed while doing their jobs just this year. That number is outpacing last year. Among those killed, the five journalists here in the United States who were doing their jobs in Annapolis at the Capital Gazette when a gunman came in and opened fire over a grudge about coverage. You know, this year, the United States has the third highest number of journalists killed worldwide. The third highest.
Yeah. I know. It's certainly a difficult, fascinating, and horrifying time for journalists in this country and abroad right now. And I definitely want to talk about that. But first, talk to me a little bit about, I mean, you were both, James Foley and yourself, foreign correspondents. You did that for most of your career thus far.
I did.
I mean, it feels to me sometimes it takes a very special and specific kind of journalist or person to do that kind of work. I mean, did you always...
Crazy?
Maybe crazy. You said
I think that's what you're implying.
Did you always know that that was the kind of work you wanted to do?
I didn't. I came to journalism late. I left university. I'd studied Latin American studies, and I was interested in the world around me. I was interested in engaging in the world. I sort of went traveling for a couple of years and taught English in Asia. And I came back and thought, what is it that I want to do? How can I really talk to people and tell their stories? And I had always been interested in journalism, but I had no idea how to do it or get involved in it. And so I ended up going to school to do journalism. I went back to school, and then I got an internship with the Associated Press. I had a wonderful mentor, and she had been at it for a long time, and the Kosovo War was going on. And she said, I was in my 20s. I'd never covered any of this stuff. And she said, hey, do you want to go do this? And I said, okay. And then I went, and it was so overwhelming. It was such an important, all of a sudden I felt like, wow, what I'm doing really matters here. Covering conflicts, telling people's stories at the worst moment of their life is so important. And it really just overtook me, and that's what I based my career around.
And you, like Jim Foley, started off freelance. I mean, I think
I
sometimes people forget. I mean, that's how much of our international news gets to us. I mean, how do you navigate that? Do you just parachute into a place, like you're saying, and, you know, keep editors always on the phone? Or how does it work?
I mean, it works differently for different journalists. I mean, a lot of the news that you get does come from freelancers because, as you may know, there's a crisis in news. A lot of news organizations simply don't have the money anymore to do international coverage. It's so expensive to keep a full-time reporter in the field. I mean, it really, really is. And so a lot of news outlets have relationships with freelancers. These freelancers take it upon themselves to go out to a specific part of the world where they may have a connection, they may speak the language, and then, you know, they report and they file stories. But they do it with very few protections, with, you know, not a lot of money is paid to them. And that makes it extremely dangerous for them. And I think that's some of the work definitely that Diane and John Foley have been focusing on, because they really understand how vulnerable freelancers are.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about when you were covering some of these conflicts. I mean, how did you maintain your personal safety? Is there like a gut feeling, or is there
spidey sense?
Spidey sense, that's what you call it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you become better at it as you go on. You start to understand when you are in a conflict zone and you're in a neighborhood and all of a sudden the normal hustle and bustle of street life is absent, you start to know that something's about to happen, that maybe the insurgent groups have told the local population to stay inside because they're about to launch an attack. There's just things that you start to know and to realize about the environment that you're operating in. But I think that And I think anyone who has worked in conflicts will tell you it's also the luck of the draw. You can do certain things to protect yourself. You can have, you know, flak jackets, which are important, and helmets and all the safety equipment, and really try and take as much care as you can to plan your trips, to make sure that you try and observe protocols, of which there are many. But at the end of the day, if you're in a hostile environment, if you're in a conflict zone, you are in danger and something terrible could happen. And I've had a lot of terrible things happen.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's also the internal dialogue of, you know, I want to get my microphone closer to the action, but I also need to protect myself. I mean, how do you decide?
I don't know. I mean, you have to sort of make that decision on a case-by-case basis. I was in Iraq for many, many years during the worst of the violence there. Yeah. And one day we were in a compound, and that's how many journalists live there. We sort of had compounds that had armed guards around them. We'd group together. And there was an attack launched on our compound. A suicide truck bomber came in with other militants and started opening fire on the guards, killed them. Then they put the truck inside and blew it up. And that basically really damaged the building we were in. It killed a very close friend of mine who was the driver for another news organization. And it was really terrible. And I remember at the time we were, the bomb went off and I had to decide, I need to go out and I need to sort of report on this and see what's happened. But at the same moment, you're in the middle of it and I don't know if there's another attacker out there. And it's not only my life that I'm putting at risk, because I work with local staff, producers, so many other people. And so if I go out there and make that decision, it's not just my life that I'm putting at risk. I'm putting at risk all the other people that work with us. So it is balancing that all the time. Every single decision you make has massive repercussions.
Oh, it's such incredible work, too. And you've lived in so many interesting places. You're based in places like Brazil, Israel, Mexico, and Iraq, as you mentioned, while you're reporting for NPR. But I'd love to spend a little time, if you are willing, on your reporting on the Arab Spring. I mean, it's what you are very well known for, especially from our listeners here. You were one of the first reporters to enter Libya after the uprising. So I want to take us back to 2011, even though it feels like, I mean, gosh, decades ago now.
It does.
But just to remind listeners what it sounded like and felt like, I mean, let's listen to some of Lulu's reporting. This is from August 2011 in Muammar Gaddafi's compound as the rebels took over.
I am indeed inside Bab al-Azizia, Gaddafi's stronghold, and the place where ordinary Libyans could never get to. And I can tell you right now that thousands of them are streaming into this compound after it was taken earlier today. The scenes of celebration are absolutely incredible. Also, a real sense of chaos. Many of the people here have gone in and are looting a very large weapons storage facility that they found, and they're carrying anything they can get their hands on. So it's a real scene of chaos, but jubilation. People are just ecstatic. They say that they feel this is really the end of the war. This is where they wanted to get to. These past 6 months, the symbol of his power, and now they feel that even though they haven't captured him, they don't know where he is effectively defeated.
And is there any resistance to them at all from inside the compound, or do they have the free run of the place now?
They have the free run of the place. I mean, I can't even tell you what I'm seeing right now. People are literally running in here, and the sound that you can hear behind me of shooting is celebratory gunfire. At one point, they actually fired an RPG into Gaddafi's house, setting it ablaze, and just... the smiles on their faces as they're running into this compound is really something to behold.
Oof, Lulu. Great. Take us to your, I mean, you were taking us there, that's for sure. But, you know, bring us into your brain in that moment and
It's terrifying.
How that was all going.
Well, it's terrifying because, yes, it's celebratory, right? It actually was. People were just shooting guns into the air and they felt like, you know, this was a really important symbolic moment for the conflict. But at the same time, there's a lot of guns and there's a lot of shooting. And shortly after I finished that, a bullet literally whizzed past me and sort of embedded itself into a door
near
me.
And are you by yourself in this moment? Or?
So I am. I mean, I am effectively by myself. I was there with other journalists. Mm-hmm. For that particular conflict, I was working with other reporters who were from other news organizations. Mm-hmm. And we frequently did that in the Middle East. We'd sort of pool our resources. It's not great to be alone. And so the way we went into Libya was kind of impromptu, if you will. We were covering Egypt's uprising. We heard that Libya was starting to really get hot, as you say, and there was a lot of protests. And so we drove down to the border with Libya, and all of a sudden, the guards sort of collapsed and we just decided, hey, I think we can walk over the border.
Okay.
And we did. And then all of a sudden we were in Libya and we did not know what we were going to find on the other side. And that was one of the first times in my life where I realized I do not know what is on the other side of this border. I do not know who these people are. I have no idea what it is that they want. This is going to be one of the most interesting and exciting stories that I could possibly tell, and it was.
Well, it certainly was. And so when you have all that unknown, how do you begin your reporting? I mean, how do you even start calling back to Washington and saying, okay, well, this is what I'm seeing, this is what, you know, how do you rank what's newsworthy, what's just like...
It's so hard. I always try and tell both my editors and the audience what I know and what I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one of the things that journalists are really, we're always expected to know everything, and we're always expected that to sort of really have a sense of what's going on. But in a moment like that, I think to repeat often and over, this is unknown territory. We really don't know what's going on. It's unclear who the players are right now. This was also a country that had been pretty much closed off to Western reporters.
I'm sure you were the first Western reporter probably many people had ever met.
And
right?
That was absolutely right. We went to towns and they had never seen a Western journalist before. And that was an extraordinary thing to sort of have that rapport, to have to ask people questions. They had no idea how to talk to a reporter, what you were there for, what you wanted. And so part of my job is not only talking to my audience back home, but really also representing what journalism and journalists do to people who may not have that familiarity. And you have a responsibility to them too, to make sure that you're honoring their story and telling their story in a way that doesn't feel exploitative.
Well, that is certainly a big balance. And then there's also the, you know, self-care, as you, I mean, how you've spent time in some of the deadliest places for journalists in the world. I mean, in some of the stories you told, I'm thinking of, you know, the battle in Gaddafi's hometown. You're describing these dead bodies with flies on them. And I mean, there was a disclaimer before the story aired to say to listeners, you know, you, this may be disturbing. I mean, there's no disclaimer for you. You're showing up and you're covering what you see. I mean, how do you manage seeing all that loss and tragedy and handling the mental toll it takes on you?
Well, I had PTSD. I'm very open about that, post-traumatic stress disorder. I've always felt that it's important to talk about it openly so that there is less of a stigma around post-traumatic stress disorder. It is not only soldiers that have post-traumatic stress disorder. It is journalists and so many other people who work in situations that where they have to sort of face really difficult situations. So, you know, emergency responders, hospital workers, all sorts of people suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, and I did. And it's something that, you know, you never get rid of. You still struggle with it, and I still struggle with it in certain ways. And it doesn't mean that you can't cover conflicts. It doesn't mean that you can't go out and tell people's stories. But it does mean that you have to be very careful and very sure that you're taking care of yourself and learning how to take a step back when you need to. Because when you're seeing people dead and wounded and they've lost their families, they've lost everything, it is a natural human response to feel enormous empathy and to just feel your heart breaking, but it can pull everything out of you and you can feel like there's nothing left for yourself, and that can be very hard.
And so did you have to take some of these steps back that you mentioned?
Absolutely. You know, during the Iraq War, I stopped going for about 8 months. I just couldn't do it anymore. I was feeling enormously depressed. I was having a lot of trouble sleeping. I was having a lot of trouble communicating with people outside of a war zone, because once you're living in a war zone for so long, that becomes your normal. That becomes the thing that just feels like all this chaos becomes really, really normal. And when you're in a regular place walking on the streets, in a safe city and town, that's the thing that feels strange. And so that's not healthy. So you have to learn how to flip it around.
Well, we're so glad for all the work that you've done. And so coming up, we're going to talk about much more of it, more with Lulu Garcia Navarro about her hosting gig at NPR. She's transitioned over the last couple of years into a new role. You hear her every Sunday afternoon. What questions do you have for her about her work at NPR? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email at theexchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back with Lulu after the break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And today we're hanging out with NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro, a familiar voice to many of you listeners. She's now the host of Weekend Edition Sunday, but she spent most of her career abroad reporting from the Middle East and Latin America. Many of you recall her vivid reports on the Arab Spring years ago. Well, she's in town to honor journalist James Foley, and Lulu gave the keynote speech yesterday as Foley was honored by the New Hampshire Supreme Court Society. And so for the rest of our time together in The Exchange, we're going to talk about her hosting gig. And we, of course, want to hear from you. So send your questions to theexchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email us at theexchange@nhpr.org. And so, Lulu, before we get back to your hosting gig, I guess this is all kind of the same thing, but I want to talk a little bit about what you talked about last night at the Foley event, and that is freedom of the press. I mean, it's, of course, essential to the reporting we were just talking about that you did abroad. It's essential to the reporting we do here every day. But I think it's safe to say it's something that all of us journalists have been thinking about lately. And yesterday, you mentioned Venezuela under Hugo Chavez and how we're not Venezuela here in the United States. But you made some really interesting comparisons. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the things that working overseas has taught me is that when I came back to the United States and I saw how deeply polarized this country is, it reminded me of other places that I had covered. Here in the United States, we think that everything here is unique and that the situation that we're going through has no other precedence anywhere else. But
right.
that's just not true. We've seen other societies just really fall into this trap of polarization where, you know, it's like red team, blue team, and you define yourselves by that. And you're not having a conversation anymore. You're just literally shouting at each other. And that was really hard to watch when I came here. And I think that it reminded me a lot of some of the things that I've seen in other countries, and particularly Venezuela is an interesting example, because when Hugo Chavez, who was the leftist leader, came to power there, he was very strategic in really trying to target the press. They had a thriving international press there, not international, they had a thriving national press there. And again, it obviously is not the United States.
Very different.
Weak institutions, all sorts of things, very, you know, large portion of the population, very poor and impoverished, a lot of corruption. So again, I understand all the caveats, but he did really target the press, and he started by naming, you know, journalists by name, and then you'd see physical attacks on the media, and then there were legal restrictions on the media, and it went so far as that now you really don't have an independent free press there. And I think one of the things that is so important to me at this particular moment is, you know, freedom of the press in the United States is not a partisan issue. We are all protected by the same laws here, whether you like Fox News or you like MSNBC. Those are the same laws for everyone. It is part of the fundamental fabric of this society. And I think that when we look at what journalists do and what we try to do every day, which is tell people stories and get the news out, you can like what you hear, you cannot like what you hear, but there is, for the fact-based media, a real responsibility and a connection. And I think that it's important that we understand that freedom of the press is an American value for all of us.
And given that, I mean, something I think about a lot is how do we cover when there are incidents where press are mistreated? And I'm thinking of, you know, I was driving in my car the day after the election, listening to the president's press conference and hearing, you know, and I felt so uncomfortable as a reporter, you know, thinking about the way he was speaking to people, you know, telling reporters their questions are a question is racist, you know, eventually
or stupid,
revoking press credentials from Jim Acosta from CNN. And my thought was, how and who will cover it? That part of the story, not just what he's talking about the midterms, you know, and how do we do that adequately but responsibly as journalists covering this issue of journalism? What do you think?
I think that it is incredibly challenging, and I don't think that there's a consensus. I say, and this is true, that every day I go into work feels like a journalism class, a master class in journalism, because the things that we're discussing are exactly those issues. When we see the press, like it or not, and we are uncomfortable being the story, but we are the story because we are being discussed and targeted. There's a huge debate about coverage and bias and who gets to say what and how we cover things. And this president has made it central to his message that the media is part of the problem as he sees it. And many of the people who support him also support that view. And so as we're trying to be objective and as we're trying to discuss these things, we are part of the story.
Right.
And so the danger for me, I'll bring it also back to Venezuela, is that Venezuelan journalists will tell you that they made a big mistake there, which is they became radicalized because they were constantly being attacked, and they became the thing that Chavez was trying to make them into.
Yeah,
they became
back, yeah.
the enemy of the people. And so I think that's a warning. I think that that's something that I keep in my mind a lot. We need to define our own moment. We need to do our own work. We need to make sure that we're behaving responsibly. We have check guards in place. We have editors and all the different, you know, we are accountable to the people. If you make a mistake, you have to correct it. If you make an egregious mistake, you're fired. So we are accountable. We need to keep on explaining what it is that we do and how we do it. Radical transparency, I think, is one of the things that's super important. And then beyond that, I think we really need to think about the way that we cover ourselves and our relationship with this president. And I don't know that the best way is to make every single attack or every single comment into a huge news story. There's a lot going on in this country, a lot. And we're part of it, but we're not the biggest part of it.
Remember, one of the criticisms during the election was, you know, CNN or other networks would air these, you know, rallies in their entirety with no, you know, pop in. I mean, how, as a host, do you do that?
And also, that's the criticism on the left.
Sure.
They blame the media
exactly.
for absolutely being a part, as they see it, of the creation of President Trump. On the right, they see it completely differently. You know, they see that unmitigated attacks against the president, you know, the Hillary Clinton emails mm-hmm. Weren't given enough oxygen, according to them. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter who is having this argument. Everyone's unhappy.
Right, right.
I always tell the story. I have Trump supporters in my family. I have Democrats in my family. And after the 2016 election, I was in Brazil. I did not cover it.
Okay.
Neither side spoke to me because I brought them together because they hated the press. They
you
were
united
furious.
Them.
I united them. They were furious at the media for different reasons. And
yeah.
and so what do you do in a situation like that? You know, we are because the press, the media, and I hate using the media because it's sort of a catch-all, but I'm going to use it for now, the fact-based media. You know, we are a common denominator. We're always trying to reach the biggest audience that we can. We need it for our economic survival, but also it's our mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are uniters. What do we do when the conversation is so divisive, where the same report can be viewed through a partisan lens in completely different ways? How do you then discuss what we do, and how do you then reach people? People just don't want to hear it anymore, and they're super mistrustful. And I'm afraid it is one of my deepest concerns that I don't know that you can win that back necessarily.
Yeah. I know. And I've had, you know, Democratic voters here in New Hampshire and Republican voters here say to me in separate conversations, I feel like I live in an alternate universe.
Mm-hmm.
And they often do both speak the same language, just with a different bend. You know, before the midterms, I had voters say to me, I would say, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so from New Hampshire Public Radio, you know, and she says, I'm so filled with hate and anger, and I'm sick of the hate and anger, and I'm voting. And I'm like, well, are you a Democrat or a Republican? I mean, because I hear the same thing from people on both sides, and it's like the feelings are the same, but the ideas about the policies are so, so different. And it's like, how do you bridge the divide?
I don't know. I think, you know, people have to make those choices themselves. And I think, you know, if you're really tired of the hate and division, then you have to do something to mm-hmm. sort of heal the hate and division. Yesterday, after my speech for the Foleys, there was someone at the New Hampshire Supreme Court who said that that my speech had really moved them because I was talking about journalist deaths and the responsibility of a free press. And he said, and I'm a Republican. And I looked at him and I said, you're an American.
Yeah.
That's what you are. And this is for all of us. This is not one thing or another. And it's nowadays people define themselves first by party. And I think I've seen this in other countries. It's not great.
And the conversation about journalism becoming partisan, I think, is the most difficult and problematic thing as a political reporter, where it's, you know, I've had Democratic politicians come up to me and say, I just want to say thank you so much for what you do. And I'm like, no, we're still... It just puts me in such an odd spot where
right.
I'm like, you know, thank you. But also, where's the line now? And I'm not for you. I'm not for this person over here. I'm for our listeners, you know, and it's become such a unique situation. I also think, and I'd be curious to hear your perspective on this as well, is that not everyone sees how damaging or understands how damaging it could be to have someone like a president. I'm not saying because he's a Republican or because he's President Trump or whomever, saying that journalists are the enemy of the people, because that does trickle down to normal people, you know?
It trickles down to normal people. It trickles down to the international media all mm-hmm. over the world, who are in much more vulnerable places. The term fake news has sort of metastasized all over the world and is being used by demagogues everywhere
right.
To talk about coverage that they don't like. And for me, part of the problem in this particular country at this particular time is that many people, because local journalism has collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing vast news deserts in this country where they don't have anymore a local paper or a local NPR station.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any connection with journalism. And so when they might see a journalist is like on TV, or they might fly into their community, but they don't see them in the same way as someone who is my next door neighbor, who cares about the same things I do and is covering the school board meeting to make sure that people are kept honest. And we've seen quantifiable studies that show that when you don't have local news outlets in your community, costs of government go up because there's no one looking into contracts, less civic engagement, people vote less. So it has real ramifications that affect us all as Americans.
So we are talking to Lulu Garcia Navarro. She's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. And we're talking about all kinds of things today, press freedom, her reporting abroad. And we got a question from a listener. And that is, I've enjoyed Lulu's reporting and hosting. I have a question for her. When she was in Brazil, she was called Lourdes. I'm sure you get this all the time.
All the time.
I'm curious why that was done, says our listener.
The artist formerly known as Lourdes, as I like to call myself. So when I took over the host chair, everyone calls me Lulu. Mm-hmm. My mother calls me Lulu since I was a little girl. Nobody that knows me calls me Lourdes except on air. And I felt that it was a good moment as I was sort of transitioning into a new role and sort of reintroducing myself to the NPR audience to just kind of call myself what everybody else calls me. And so I decided to make the switch. But I get the question all the time.
No way, really?
The first thing that everyone always asks me, and they always think that there's like a more interesting story behind it, but there isn't. I feel like I need to bring my mom on to have like a testimonial.
You should
where
bring
she's
Cape
like,
with you everywhere. Yeah. Like, hi, my name is Lulu's mom.
And she was called Lulu as a baby, and everyone knows her as Lulu.
We fact checked it. All right, well, good. That's so funny. I think when you say your name so often on public radio, I mean, I get questions about married name, you know.
People know you in a certain way. Also, because I know so many of the hosts over the years, they would, you know, they'd introduce a piece for me in here and be like, here's Lourdes Garcia Navarro. Hi, Lulu. And then people would write in and be like, who's Lulu?
Really?
Yeah. And so they would get confused. And so there was at a certain moment they said, you can't call her Lulu on air anymore. It has to just be Lourdes. And so I just decided to go the other way.
This is like hashtag NPR problems, Lulu, I think.
I think it is.
So let's talk about your hosting gig. It's been about 2 years now. So are you having fun? I mean, what have you enjoyed about the job?
I have. So for the first year, people would always ask me, are you having fun? And
really?
I'd be like, no, I'm not having fun.
I'm glad
terrifying.
To ask it 2 years in. Then.
2 years in, I'm having a lot of fun. 2 years in. What I love about it is just the range of stuff that I get to talk about
and
the people I get to talk to. As a reporter in the field, especially doing conflicts, there's not a lot of room for talking to Benedict Cumberbatch, sadly.
Glad you brought that up.
Yeah. So I really enjoy that part of it now. Also, I have such an amazing team of journalists. You know, working in the field is so lonely. You're often by yourself, especially as a radio reporter. I mean, TV reporters have sort of many more people with
camera
them.
Camera person or producer, right.
As a radio correspondent, you know this. It's you and your microphone often doing stuff by yourself. And that can feel pretty isolating. And so now being in an office and working with the amazing team of people who are so smart and just going in the morning and being able to sit around a table and it's not just all on me. I don't have to make all the decisions about what's going to happen. In fact, it's really collaborative. I love it.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, you know, what are the big questions you and your team kind of grapple with about what do we want to put on the air this week, especially when news moves extra,
well, this
extra
is the point, this right. is the big thing about being a weekend show, right? Because if you're a daily show, it's just like you're covering the news. But it's one of the things I love about being a weekend show because we take a step back and we're having conversations that are sort of what I like to call news adjacent. So they're related to the news, but you're allowed to go in deeper. Mm-hmm. You're thoughtful about what the guest that you're going to have come on because we are getting whiplash now. I mean, it's crazy. It's like you can't take a breath without some
keep up
without some big news breaking. And so we get to have an opportunity to sort of, what are the trends? You know, what news did we miss this week that is actually really important? And I think the other thing is give people some joy, give people a break. It's, you know, life goes on and it's not all news alerts and the drum beats of imminent disaster. There's a lot going on in the world that is happy and fun and interesting. And, you know, we need to give people a little of that, too.
It's Benedict Cumberbatch.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
So since we brought it up, I mean, those interviews, I feel, are so interesting because, yes, they're happy and joyful and Christmas, but they're also, you know, kind of, I don't know, they're a little deep, right? It's
still they're super deep.
You talk about the loneliness of the Grinch in that one.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. Because one of the things that I find really interesting is sometimes the best interviews on the show are coming from authors. They're coming from poets. They're coming from actors. Because as a society, what makes a society? The arts are reflective of what's happening. And they often have a different view and a different filter. And so I love these conversations. I absolutely find them so interesting and intriguing. Because they kind of break down our initial sort of maybe partisan thing where we're like, oh, this is a politician X talking about politician X. I don't want to hear what he says. No, this is actor, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch talking about loneliness and healing and reaching out to someone who might feel isolated and might be doing bad things and how to bring them back into a community. I mean, you might listen to that. And we know what we're talking about. We're talking about the society that we live in. And yet, you know, you might listen in a different way because it's Benedict Cumberbatch. He's got a great voice.
Yes, he does. And I loved hearing that they were considering him being a British Grinch. And then
he was very anti that. He was very anti that.
I love it. And it sounds like you're doing a bit of traveling still in this role.
Absolutely.
I mean, you did hosting and reporting from Las Vegas before the midterm. So
Mexico, Las Vegas, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. I mean, not only me, but all my other hosts are, you know, traveling.
How do
and
you
going out there?
Yeah, and when you go out there, I mean, give us a sense of you parachute into a place, and sometimes if it's Las Vegas, it's a place where a lot of journalists have been because of a tragedy. So how do you try and find that unique spin, and how do you kind of send your team?
Well,
out?
I've always been a reporter, so
you know what to do.
So you know what to do. You're a reporter too, right? I mean, that's what we do. We actually try and see what stories haven't been covered. What can I bring to this? I always say I like to report with a scalpel and not a butter knife. I don't like to go in as a parachute reporter, as someone who I always used to live in the countries that I covered, which I did for, you know, all of my career. For me, it was like really important to, if you're going to parachute in, to try and do it justice and to try and tell a story that maybe a national audience hadn't heard. And so that's what we've tried to do. And I also think if you're sitting in a studio, it is so important to get out and talk to people. Every place that I've gone, I have learned vital things that I can then bring to the host chair.
That is like peak journalism 101 right there. It's so important to get out. And I think, you know, when I've been listening back to all your interviews in preparation for our chat, I mean, you also have to balance so many different emotions in each show. I mean, during reporting in Las Vegas or during your broadcast interviews, when you are in the studio, and I'm thinking specifically of this interview you did this week with Lauren Lighthall. He's the principal of Paradise High School. I mean, Paradise, of course, has just been devastated by the fire. So let's take a little listen to that interview.
Before we talk about your school, I have to ask, how are you and your family doing?
We're doing okay. I have 7 kids and a dog, and so it's our house has been completely destroyed, and it's hard for people to want to take in all those people. So we're extremely grateful for our faith community. We're Mormons, and that for people that were able to take us in and support us and give us a place to hang our heads and feel safe.
That must be pretty devastating.
It's been tough just because all the things that you love about your life, your yearbooks and your wedding rings and anything that's ever important to you was gone. Even though we plan for these things and we have document boxes, it was just so frantic that we just left. We feel very grateful that we were able to just get out with our lives.
Have you been able to tell the kids that the house is gone?
We just told them. I don't know that they quite get it. You know, they are worried about their Xbox or, you know, their pull-up bar or personal things. But I don't know that they get the gravity of the situation.
Oh, that was a tough one. I mean, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you could have just rolled right into the house, the school. And,
no.
But tell me why you didn't do that.
Because this is a real person going through a real thing. And, you know, they have a story to tell. And also, when I go into an interview like that, I actually don't know what they're going to tell me. I don't know what their experience is. And that's a really important thing for people to hear. And also, I'm a human being, comforting another human being at one of the worst moments in their life. And I think it's really important to hear that.
I think, too, it must be, you know, you've covered so much tragedy in your life. I mean, I feel like you probably can go to an even deeper place because of the thing. I mean, we all can, but it seems like you can tap into something. You've seen so much. I know war is obviously different than a fire, but it's all loss. It's all tragedy. I mean, how has your past job been able to help you with these tough conversations?
I think it's been essential. I think when you see something like this, you know, I have had to talk to people at moments when their lives are falling apart. And I know that, you sometimes, you know, it's a weird thing because sometimes they don't want to talk to you. Sometimes they really feel angry and you can be the target of that anger. And sometimes they need to talk to you. Sometimes they want to talk to you. They want to feel heard and they're trying to process something through that conversation with you. And I think the, you know, what journalists do is really try and figure out where that moment lies. And I've been in situations where massive disasters, earthquakes, hurricanes, you know, wars. And if someone doesn't want to talk to me, I say, I'm very sorry for what's happened to you. And of course, and I go and find someone else to talk to who might feel the need to have that conversation. And I think that that's the thing about what we do. It's not just about preying upon people's worst moment. It actually is about sometimes giving people comfort and allowing them to talk about the thing that's just happened.
Well, we're so glad that you're doing it. And before we let you go, I was wondering, what have you, Lulu, been listening to lately? That, I mean, we have Thanksgiving travel coming up. You're listening to a lot of things for work, obviously. I didn't know if there was any recommendation you had for our listeners.
So NPR has a new podcast. It's called Believed.
Oh, yes.
And it's about Larry Nassar and the women and girls that he abused for two decades and how they found the courage to actually take him down. And I think it is definitely worth a listen. Not exactly the cheeriest stuff, but I think actually at this particular moment in time, a story about how people get their voices heard and get to, you know, affect change is a good thing.
That is a good thing. And, you know, even if it's dark or difficult to hear, sometimes that's really important.
Sometimes it is. Inspiring.
So inspiring for sure. And thank you for always having those difficult conversations. This is Lulu Garcia Navarro. She hosts in the morning. I keep saying the afternoon for some reason. Host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday in the morning and former foreign correspondent. We've been so thankful to have her. Thank you, Lulu.
My pleasure.
And so coming up, we're going to stick with podcasts as we were just talking about and journalism. We're going to talk with Taylor Quimby. He's NHPR's producer extraordinaire. He's worked on shows you know like Word of Mouth, Outside In, and recently the Bear Brook podcast. He just finished a piece for Outside In that took a really interesting and kind of introspective turn. So we're going to dig into that story and some of the journalistic ethics about taking sides. Should be a fun chat. So make sure you stick around. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Joining the Leadership Circle is a vote of confidence in NHPR's mission.
Leadership Circle member Jake Voinas.
I think there's sort of an incredible importance in investing in the things that you value. And I was attracted to the opportunity to really lean in and invest in a resource that means a lot to me and many others in New Hampshire.
You too can lean in to NHPR when you invest $100 a month or make a one-time gift of $1,200 at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen. I've been filling in for Laura Kanoy, the great Laura Kanoy. But tomorrow, Peter Biello will be here in the host chair. He's going to talk to New Hampshire author Howard Mansfield about the definition of property. What does it mean and who really owns property? Should be a pretty thoughtful conversation. So you'll be good in good hands tomorrow with Peter. But this hour, we've been talking about journalism, and we're going to stick with that for the rest of the show. Every newsroom across the country and likely across the planet has at least one person who calls all the time, and I mean all the time, a concerned citizen or a political gadfly who wants, or maybe it's more accurately that they need to be heard. And sometimes it's to complain, other times it's to pitch a story, but they're always calling or emailing about something. You get it. Well, my NHPR colleague Taylor Quimby, who is here, he did the thing that many of us reporters really don't always do in that situation. He called one of those people back, and I think it's accurate to say, Taylor, it brought you down kind of an introspective path.
It did very much,
so thank you for coming on and going down it again with us.
I'm going to do my best. I'm best with the scripted stuff, but, you know, I can do live.
Oh, come on. You're going to be great. So first, why don't you tell us a little bit about Laura Slitt and your interactions with her, you know, from way, way back.
Okay, so I started at NHPR in 2010. In 2011, I became a producer for Word of Mouth, which has been around and changed a lot over the years, but, you know, has always been a magazine show that covers lots of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
ever since I've been working on that show and afterwards, I've been getting emails and occasionally voicemails from a woman named Laura Slitt. And Laura is a vegan advocate.
Okay.
That's personally, not professionally. She is very vocal. She writes emails that often are in all caps. It can be very forceful. Her voicemails can run several minutes. They have filled up my machine before. And, you know, everything to Laura should be about animal rights and should be about switching to a vegan diet. And so, you know, I mean, just as an example, there was, I think in 2014, it was the Oscars. Do you remember Ellen DeGeneres was hosting and she took a selfie with a bunch of famous people
in the front.
Yes. And it got retweeted a bazillion times. And we on Word of Mouth did a segment after that that was talking about photography rights, because apparently it had sort of opened this question. Did Ellen own that photo or did Bradley Cooper, who clicked the button,
like the
own
monkey
that photo?
In the This American Life episode?
Exactly.
Where the monkey takes the photo and they're like, well, the monkey's owning it. Anyway,
exactly.
So I digress.
So we did a story about that, about photography rights. Well, Laura left a very long and angry message on my voicemail the next day that was about how the story should have been about the fact that Ellen DeGeneres has raised a lot of money for the Humane Society.
What?
Yeah. Now let me say,
which is, you know, could be an interesting story.
It could be an interesting story. And I think that there's something to point out here is that we're used to getting feedback, and often you have to look for the nugget of truth, the good piece of critical feedback that's sometimes framed in a way that can make you feel defensive as a journalist or just as a human. You know, sometimes you get mail and you just can't even figure out how you can take that criticism very deliberately. And this was the sort of case with Laura, which is that often she's complaining not about the story that you did, but about the story that she wished you did. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it was very easy to discount her. And I think she has been emailing everybody at the station and probably at most of the other media outlets in New Hampshire for a very long time and has been largely ignored by everybody.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think she's been largely ignored? And I guess, you know, she called me once and I didn't know who she was. And I was like, guys, this woman named Laura called me about this pig scramble story I did when I first came here. Yeah. And you guys were like, oh, yeah, she calls a lot. Why do you think most people, or we all do it, don't call those people back?
Well, there's a certain element of just the approach. Like I said, I think, you know, if you can't find the critical feedback, sometimes it's not worth reaching out. And also because everything was sort of one note, or it seemed like one note to Laura, I don't know, you just can. Like, you just can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, on some level, you as a group or as an individual decide that this person is not, that you don't need to respond.
But then you did.
I did, yeah.
And why? What kind of changed your mind or changed your tune?
Well, I think there's a few different things. You know, part of it was just curiosity. Mm-hmm. You know, the voicemails the emails are all caps. They're sort of one note. The voicemails, there's a little more humanity to. When you actually speak to a person, you start to think, you know, this is a person who's more than just one thing. And so I definitely wondered, like, what is Laura like? You know, who is she as a person, as a well-rounded, complex human being? Also, I think I wanted to maybe defend, to some degree, the work that we've done on the shows that I've worked on. So there's a sort of defensive part that says, like, hey, you know what? I think we do a good job. So maybe
let me tell you about it, right?
Yeah, maybe that's a little bit about it. But also, you know, I kind of wondered, what is the show that Laura would have done? You know, what is the programming that she wants on the air? And, you know, I would say that in 2016 and 17, when I was starting to look at this, we were having a lot of conversations about climate change coverage, lots of different things. Now, she is just like an onslaught of information, but there is some truth to things that she says, especially when you think about the percentage of greenhouse gases that are attributable to animal agriculture. There is a question, like, do we cover cars more than we cover cows?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk a lot about climate change, both on Outside In, the podcast that I work on, and broadly in public radio. And there's a question of, like, when we're talking about climate change, do we always steer towards cars and industry and maybe steer away from this other thing that is a big part, 15% of our greenhouse gases? So that made me wonder, like, what if I take Laura seriously, really dig into this and try and do something that she would be interested in hearing?
And there is always a question, too, I think lately in the last couple of years of journalism, where there is a push. There are great things like Harkin, where they encourage you to talk to the people who are listening, right? I mean, we go out in the field, just like Lulu Garcia Navarro was talking about, because those are the people who have ideas. Those are the people who have thoughts. And Laura had a lot of thoughts. But there's also this other side of that, right, where there's this concern, and Lulu talked about this too, of this exploitation. And,
right.
You know, I think about the podcast S-Town that This American Life did, where this was the big question. You know, this is a podcast about this kind of eccentric man from Alabama,
John B.
McLemore.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing was downloaded nearly 80 million times. And, you know, I don't want to spoil the podcast if people haven't heard it, but he ends up dying. And so there was this big question about getting his permission, not getting his permission. But there's also this larger thing about exploiting a person. So I wonder, do you think about those things when you think about doing a story like about someone like Laura?
Yeah, we had a lot of conversations, and a lot of those conversations sort of said, hey, I mean, there are a lot of ways this could go, and a lot of them will end in us killing the story and deciding that it's not a responsible thing to do. I mean, I think what's interesting when you look at someone like Laura is that her advocacy has been very public. She writes a lot of op-eds to places like the Conway Daily Sun. She's very well known, I think, in certain places as a vegan advocate. And because she is a public figure to some extent, that means that she's open to media scrutiny in a way. On the other hand, I would not call Laura like a powerful public figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that, you know, there's some nuance there. I mean, I think you have to be sensitive about using someone to help tell the story that you want to tell. And I don't know if this is ethical or not, but I think one of the ways that we tried to deal with this in this story is that Laura is a primary character, but it's also largely a story about me. I mean, the tale that we told on Outside In is sort of about how by reaching out, is there a world in which I change Laura and Laura changes me? And the best way to try and do that in a responsible way towards Laura was to focus on my own feelings and our relationship rather than just some expose about a vegan advocate who writes a lot of emails.
And yet then that opens up all these other questions
yeah.
of like,
yeah.
we are so used to as journalists, Lulu was talking about this earlier, not being the story, but yet this is a situation where you did become the story. So talk about why you decided to do it that way and what that thought process was like.
Yeah. Well, and I should say to listeners that this is like one of those weird stories that you really kind of need to listen to.
I know.
To.
We're like talking about it, but we're not talking about it. It's
yeah.
like Fight Club. You know, it's like we want you to listen to it. So we're trying not to give too much away.
Yeah.
But it has opened up these really interesting questions about podcasts, our journalism. What are the rules? What are the same rules? And this one, you brought up two big ones, which is how you interact with sources
right.
and the relationships you build, and also putting yourself in the story. So not to interrupt, but why did you decide to do it this way?
Well, I think one reason that we don't bring ourselves into our stories is not because we are free of bias, but because we don't want bias to compromise our reporting. So you work towards being as objective as possible, and you present it in that fashion. But I think that only works to the extent that people actually feel like you are being objective.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to food, the truth is, we all eat.
It is true. We do all eat.
A reporter can choose not to vote as though that they didn't actually have a preferred candidate in mind. But a reporter cannot choose not to eat. And so conscious or not, we're all making some sort of choice based off of that. If I had tried to make a story that was about Laura without acknowledging that during this story I became a vegetarian, a lot of people would say, listen, that was biased. You should have been upfront about that. Now, if I had stayed an omnivore throughout the course of listening to this or reporting this story, and I had also not reported on my food choices, vegans and vegetarians would have said that is also biased because you are choosing to continue to eat meat. Just because most people do it does not mean that it isn't a choice that I deliberately make. And so I think that the best way to do this in a way that actually hopefully got people to listen without feeling defensive was to be upfront about how I was feeling without projecting it as though it's just the way that everybody should be feeling. So you know, I mean, that was the aim. You know, the listeners can be the judge as to whether or not I accomplished it.
Well, they'll have to listen. It's the latest episode of Outside In, as we've said. And so I want to dig into a little bit more of, you know, as you navigate these questions and as listeners will, you know, make their choice. And I know it was kind of, we still have producers in the building who are still of many minds about how you did the story, which is, man, what makes an interesting story, though, I think, is that you can have a lot of different opinions on it. So I want to know, what was the goal then for you? As you went through all these thoughts, what was the end goal?
Well, you know, you and Lulu were talking a lot about how sometimes it feels like you can't have a conversation because everybody's already sort of dug their trenches and is just shouting at each other from across, you know, some vast divide, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think food is in some ways as fundamental, if not more, than politics. And so having a conversation about food choices often makes people very defensive, no matter where you are on the spectrum.
Yeah.
I wanted to raise some of the ideas that I think Laura has been trying to get us to cover in a way that wouldn't make omnivores feel judged and defensive. I also wanted to explore some of the problems that omnivores have often had with the sort of vegan or bust ideology that advocates like Laura sometimes espouse. I just wanted to explore this topic in a way that would inspire, I think, self-reflection rather than reaction.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that, but this was sort of, from a psychological perspective, the best way I thought to really talk a lot about weird stuff in a way that people could listen to and not feel judged.
And so what was the response so far? I mean, have you gotten a good response?
It has been largely very positive. And from vegans, from vegetarians, and from omnivores, I've heard almost all nice things. There's a lot of people that said that the piece was really thought-provoking and is making them reconsider their choices. There's other people that have just felt like they were heard for thinking deliberately about the choices that they have made. I will say that it's out on a podcast, and I think if we put this out on broadcast, people would feel like the conversation was being forced on them, and I think it would be a very, very different reaction. I think if we ever put this on the radio, I will get the angry mail that I was kind of expecting in the first place but haven't gotten.
And is that because of people are making a choice to listen to it, or because why do you think the reaction would be different?
Yeah, with podcasts, it's on demand. People get to opt in. They get to look and at least just read the synopsis and say, this is what I'm listening to. They can turn it off, and I suppose you can turn off the radio too. But the radio is there regardless of whether or not you chose it. And so it does show you how differently the medium might impact how you feel about it.
And so before we let you go, though, did you hear from Laura?
I did.
What did she think?
Oh, well, so I talk to Laura all the time.
Okay,
Laura emailed me 3 times while she was listening to the piece.
Oh, really?
So I got an almost minute-by-minute
live
sort of update. She really appreciated that we did the story. She didn't agree with everything in it, which I think is probably a good thing from a reporting standpoint. But she was glad that we had the conversation, and I think she felt heard.
Well, you can hear this lovely podcast that Taylor put together on Outside In. That's Taylor Quimby, producer at NHPR. Thanks, Taylor, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It was nice to have a big conversation about journalism with Taylor and, of course, with Lulu Garcia Navarro, the host of Weekend Edition Sunday, which is on in the morning, not the afternoon, as I kept on saying. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Alan Grimm. Producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Lauren Chulgen. I've been filling in for Laura Kanoy, but tomorrow you will be in the great hands of Peter Biello. Hope you have a good day.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.